This is Miocin Kelly. The teachings you are about to receive have been freely offered. If you would like to make a donation to support their continuation, visit us at dharmaseed.org.
Evam me sutam ekam samaram bhagava.
When we notice the proliferation of self-help books, personal growth workshops, and the burgeoning shelves of spiritual books in the bookstore, we have to conclude that there's a fair amount of discontentment among us. There appears to be a spiritual hunger in our society, but there's always been a deep questioning of the meaning, the purpose, the value of human life. And so it was during the time of Prince Siddhartha the Bodhisattva. And he too heard the call to look deeper, to see what could be discovered of the truth and what could be realized of freedom. He left home and undertook the spiritual practices of his day, perfected all that was available from the teachers of his day, realized for himself what they taught and understood, and he knew from that 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 was not freedom, that that was not the end of suffering. After having searched through all that the teachers of his day had to offer, in realizing what they taught, he concluded, that's not it. He then went on his own way, his own journey, to discover for himself what truth, what freedom really is. And upon his awakening, upon his realization of the truth with a capital T, if you will, or let's just say a more profound truth than had been articulated in his day, he shared the nuggets of that truth in his first discourse on the Four Noble Truths. The Buddha taught the Four Noble Truths, and the Four Noble Truths are the bedrock of all Buddhist traditions. Zen, Tibetan, Burmese, Thai, Sri Lankan, Vietnamese. We all agree that the Four Noble Truths are the essential Dhamma, the essential truths that the Buddha taught. Now, whether the Buddha exists in the world to teach the Four Noble Truths, the Four Noble Truths are an articulation of the way things are. And the way things are is the way things are. But it takes the Buddha, or it takes a Buddha, to come into the world to be able to realize deeply the way things are, articulate them in such a way that others hear and are able to realize for themselves freedom and the end of suffering. The essence of the Buddha is one who has awoken and has taught the Four Noble Truths. Given the number of spiritual books, the different spiritual traditions, the many teachers within all those traditions, we have to wonder what in all of those books are the essential Dhamma. What is it in all of those writings that is essential for our disentangling our hearts and minds from the causes of suffering? The Buddha said the Four Noble Truths are the essential Dhamma. I want to speak about the Four Noble Truths not so much as a dogma of Buddhism, not so much as a belief that we must subscribe to, but as a way of looking at our practice. Do we see, can we see in our own practice these truths? Can we verify for ourselves these truths? If we can, great. There's a remedy, so to speak, for the causes of suffering. If we don't see in our own life, in our practice, these truths, well, the retreat's over. But I think you'll see that the way the Buddha pointed to the way things are is what we actually see moment to moment in our practice. The first noble truth is called dukkha saccha. Dukkha has its own meaning, I'll get into in a minute. Saccha means the truth. And dukkha saccha means the truth of dukkha. When I first started Dhamma practice 25 or so years ago, when the teachings of the Buddha were just really just coming to the West in a popular way, dukkha saccha was translated as life is suffering. Well, I went to my first retreat, a 2-week retreat, and I heard this Four Noble Truths, life is suffering, and I was in my early 20s, and I said, it doesn't sound right to me. My life isn't suffering. I'm 25. You know, what kind of suffering is that? You know, and I was doing my sitting and walking, and I had the usual knee pain, back pain, head pain, restless mind, wandering mind, all the hindrances, self-doubt, criticism, judgment of others, frustration at being unable to follow the directions, and sleepiness and dullness. But I wasn't suffering. The way I understood that was just, well, this is just my personal limitation. Suffering was too scary a word, really. Because if I was suffering, if I acknowledged somehow that I was suffering, it felt like I was acknowledging that I was a failure. If I'm suffering, I failed somehow. And so I didn't get it. Life is suffering. 10 years later, I went to Burma, and one of Upandita's translators translated the word dukkha as the oppressive nature of experience. Well, I could see that. You know, it's hot in Burma. That's oppressive. You know, that's oppressive. I could get it. And it was the crack that allowed me to begin to see the truth of dukkha. And what I saw with this opening to understanding and acknowledging the oppressive nature of experience was how difficult it really is to get the truth of dukkha. It really is difficult for us to take it in a meaningful way. I kept making my suffering, my oppression, personal. I personalized, you know, my family of origin stuff, my physical stuff, my emotional stuff. And by personalizing it, thinking it was mine and me, and just, you know, I was the only one that had this shameful thing, things, plural, I missed the significance of what the Buddha was actually pointing to. This dukkha, this oppressive nature of experience, it's universal. There isn't a being on the face of the earth that doesn't experience it. So what does dukkha mean? I connected with oppressive nature. Dukkha means pain. You know, the back pain that you had today, the knee pain, the sitting pain, the yogi pain. Some of you might have had hunger pain, lack of sleep pain. Physical, obvious physical pain. But it also means the obvious mental pain or emotional pain that we all at times experience. Loneliness, anxiety, fear, stress, despair, worthlessness, and I'm sure you could fill out the list. We all experience these at times. This kind of pain, physical pain and emotional pain, is so obvious. It's so apparent. It's so real. It's so tangible. It's called dukkha dukkha, just so you get it. It's dukkha dukkha. But there's a second meaning to the word dukkha that we need to open to and be aware of. And this is called viparinama dukkha. It is an acknowledgement of the fact that things change. Even though we may currently be experiencing pleasant conditions in our life, reasonably healthy, got a little time off to do a retreat, somewhat happy, maybe we got a job, we're in midlife, we've gotten through the early years, haven't yet got to the elderly years, some of us. And so we're kind of, you know, riding the crest, and life is looking pretty good. But somewhere, just on the edge of our vision, just on the periphery of the conditions of our life, we know everything is subject to change. And it really only takes a matter of minutes, in some instances, for our whole life to just unravel. All the security, all the structure, all the stability that we have relied on for our happiness, that we've depended on to feel safe, to feel secure, to feel at ease with ourselves and others, can just come undone, just like that. And we know that. It might be a diagnosis of a condition. It might be a car accident. It might be who knows what. But we know somewhere, just out of sight of our conscious mind, that that's always possible. We cannot insulate ourselves from this insecurity, no matter what we do, no matter how much stuff we acquire, no matter how secure our job, our relationships are, and no matter how organic the food is we eat. We cannot insulate ourselves from this insecurity. There's just no way to do it. And so we live with this insecurity. We live with this fear of change, knowing that we really can't control it. We could say that dukkha is hidden in pleasant experiences, because when pleasant experiences change, it's dukkha. Again, we often miss the universal nature of this truth. when we somehow, you know, run this monologue that says, if I could just get it together, if I could, you know, or when I get it together, you know, then, you know, when I finally get it together, then I'm going to be safe, secure, stable. And we hold out this possibility in our mind that there's something we can do, get, have, become, learn, know, acquire, to forever dispel this insecurity. By personalizing this insecurity, we miss the significance of the Buddha's teaching that it is not possible. It is a universal truth for all beings, whatever their condition. That's the second meaning of the word dukkha. There's a third meaning, as if those two weren't enough. And the third meaning of dukkha is called sankhara dukkha. And it refers to this situation. We're born. Our parents take care of us to the best of their ability for a few years. They feed us, they clothe us, they bathe us, they clean us several times a day for several years. And then they say, you got to do it on your own, kid. You got to feed yourself, clothe yourself, bathe yourself, house yourself, feed yourself, burp yourself, and all of that. And we have to do it. It's our responsibility. Every one of us in the room has to carry the burden, if you will, of this body and this mind. If you don't earn the money to feed it, you'll be really uncomfortable and really experiencing dukkha. If you don't take care of your mind, if you don't keep your mind distracted and happy, you are really going to be suffering. Right? And you can't just say to the body, get on with yourself. Get on by yourself. I'm done with you. You know, you just try to leave your body alone for a half hour. Just sit still. Leave it alone. You can't. We are slaves to our body and mind. We have to take care of them. Our whole life is oriented around trying to make the body and mind feel comfortable so that they don't bother us. Really? I have to do it for my body. You have to do it for your body. Now imagine if you didn't. Imagine you just, you know, you stop washing. Stop brushing your teeth and combing your hair and bathing. There. I'm done with that. That's too much bother. Suffering becomes really apparent real quick. Now, let's be honest for a minute. Isn't that oppressive? Really? Don't you have better things to do with your time? I mean, it's kind of oppressive, isn't it? But again, it's really hard to acknowledge it, because what are you going to do? Is there anything else to do? I mean, really, that's what we got to do. We got to carry this body and mind around until it dies. Now, if all we were doing, really, let's face it, if all we were doing is carrying this body and mind to the grave, what a waste of time. But we have this opportunity. And in the Buddhist teachings, they call it this precious human birth. Because with this human birth, we have the experience of pleasure, we have the experience of pain, and we have the teachings of the Buddha that point to freedom from suffering. And if we use this body and use this mind to develop understanding, compassion, connection with others, and act wisely in the world, we can minimize our suffering and the suffering of others. That's the benefit of a human life. Not just our own suffering, but we can actually relieve others of theirs too. Now, I grew up in the day and age when my parents said, look, if you can't say anything nice, don't say anything at all. And out of compassion to my family of origin and my siblings, and out of great respect to my parents, one of whom was an alcoholic, do you think there was any dukkha in our house? Do you think we talked about it? Personally, I am so thankful. I am so grateful for my Dharma teachers who brought dukkha out of the closet and said, take a look. This is what's going on in our lives. There's this vast conspiracy of silence around this First Noble Truth. Our practice here, and the Dharma, practice of the Dharma, is to investigate this First Noble Truth. It's to investigate dukkha. It's to look and see, is this true? Is this true? If it isn't true, what a relief. If it is true, it's better we know about it. Now I'm going to ask you. You seen any dukkha in your life? You seen any dukkha in your mind, in your body? Pretty obvious, isn't it? It's pretty apparent. It's important to discover dukkha. It's important to really look. It's important to sit still so that you can feel what the body is really like. It's important to not let the mind distract itself so you can see what the mind is really like. Because when we open to the truth of dukkha, when we open to the universal truth of dukkha, that all beings experience this dukkha, then we're not satisfied to just pursue the next pleasure, the next thing, the next person, the next event, the next pleasant experience, because that's not the end of dukkha. That's just covering it up, it's denying it, it's distracting yourself so you don't have to feel it, you don't have to notice it. It's important to discover this truth of dukkha, because only then will we do anything about it. So now, the question. Do you suffer? And secondly, do you care about your suffering? Did you ever ask yourself, why I am not yet content with my life? Fully fulfilled, content, at ease, whatever, however you want to articulate it. Why isn't it yet enough? Well, the Buddha asked, or the Bodhisattva asked also, why am I still discontent? Why do I still experience dukkha? In one sort, one form or another. And when he looked, he saw that the cause of dukkha is craving. This is the second noble truth. Craving is the source of our discontentment. Craving is the source of our stress. Craving is the source of our anxiety. Craving is the source of our fear, our despair, our depression, our hopelessness. Craving is the source of dukkha, the cause of dukkha. Now, craving, we know, wanting, yearning, longing, attachment, identification. We're not wanting dukkha. But the Buddha said, it's the very craving, it's the very wanting that is the source, the cause of dukkha. Now, I have this thought, or I have this belief that kind of runs, this monologue that kind of runs in the back of my mind, that says, if I could only get what I want, then I'd be happy. Don't you have something like that in your mind that says, if I could just get what I want, you know, a little more money, a newer car, or, you know, the house I want, or, you know, chocolate for lunch, whatever. I mean, whatever it is. If I could just get what I want, then... And the Buddha said, that's the very source of your suffering. Right there. He said, if you want something and you don't get it, it's pretty obvious. That's dukkha. Right? But he said, if you want something and you get it, that's also dukkha. Can't win. Why? Because what did you have to do to get that? How long is it going to last? If it's worth anything, you have to insure it. If you earn too much, or if it's worth too much, the government's going to take some of it. And eventually it's going to grow old, break, get stolen, wear out, rust, or be superseded by something faster, brighter, this year's color. You can't hang on to it. The satisfaction that it, whatever it is, offers, is so brief, so momentary, so ephemeral, it's not fair, it's not even reasonable to call that happiness. Satisfaction, maybe, briefly, but certainly not happiness. What did you want today? Did you want a good sitting? Did you want a nap after lunch? Did you want it quiet in the hall? Did you get it? Briefly? Did you feel satisfied? And for how long? Even if you get what you want, it doesn't last. It said, or the Buddha said, that we crave pleasant experience. Well, that seems pretty obvious, doesn't it? We want to be comfortable in the body. We want to hear pleasant sounds, not loud, irritating sounds. We want to eat pleasant, tasteful food, not bland, untasty food. We want to feel comfortable in the body. We don't want to feel uncomfortable in the body. We like pleasant things. We like pleasant experiences. We crave for pleasant experiences. And we get some. The Buddha said that we also crave continued existence. What's that mean? Continued existence. Without getting too esoteric, did you have a future in mind today? Did you have planning mind today? Remember when you were planning? What were you doing? You're imagining the future. Sometime in the future, you know, later in the day, end of the retreat, next year, when you get enlightened, something. You're imagining what it would be like then. And now, we're laying down those tracks to continue our existence then, out there in the future somewhere. We don't have to look too far. What does it mean to crave continued existence? Well, whatever you want to become, you will. You'll get that opportunity. Just keep existing in our continued existence. It said that we also crave non-existence. Well, that's kind of scary. What's that mean? without getting, again, too esoteric. Do you have any discomfort in the body or mind today? You know, where the mind was just driving you nuts. And you say to yourself, or you have this little monologue going in the back of your mind, says, gee, I wish this would end. I wish I could get rid of this thing. I wish I didn't have to experience this right now. I wish I didn't exist to experience this. Poof. There. I don't have to experience that. I don't exist anymore. Well, so we crave pleasant experiences. We crave existence. We crave non-existence. It really doesn't matter what we crave. It's the craving itself that's the source of the dukkha. When we begin to see this in our practice, we notice that whenever we're not with things just as they are, we're suffering. Whenever we can't be with just this, just whatever this is, when we're elsewhere, into the future, into the past, into the fantasy, resisting the way things are, we're suffering. But when we turn our mind to just being with the way things are, that suffering really is not there. It's said that the first noble truth is to be investigated, to discover dukkha in the body and the mind. The second noble truth of craving is to be abandoned. When we abandon craving temporarily, when we're with things as they are, craving ceases, dukkha with it. Now, if the Buddha had stopped with these two truths, truth of dukkha, caused by craving, good luck, that'd be difficult. I mean, what are we going to do? But he went on further, and he realized that there is an end to dukkha. That dukkha can be brought to an end. It's said that after the Bodhisattva practiced, realized the truth, he became a Buddha. And then for 7 weeks, 7 weeks, he enjoyed the bliss of that freedom. Standing for a week, sitting for a week, lying down for a week. Really. You know, just kind of, wow, grooving on the bliss. No more suffering. During that time, he considered what to do with the rest of his life. Something like planning mine without attachment. Really, the consideration was whether to teach or not. Whether to try to point out what he had realized to others. And I imagine, I don't know what the Buddha was actually doing, but I can imagine him thinking, what do I want to do? Do I want to teach? Or do I just want to wander off into Himalayas and kind of groove on the bliss? Great. And then, well, what is it I've realized? This is not really easy to get. That craving is a source of dukkha. But there's an end to it. The end of dukkha, or the abandonment of craving, is actually pretty subtle. It's not neon lights. It's not Las Vegas loud. The end of suffering is really pretty immediate for all of us and pretty subtle. And the Buddha said of the end of suffering, the third noble truth, it is subtle, it's profound, it's hard to see. It's not that it's so difficult, it's so, you know, complex and so esoteric and so far out. It's so simple. What does sitting on our cushion here have to do with the end of suffering? Don't answer that yet. Let me point to several ways to understand the answer to that question. One way we see the end of dukkha in our practice when mindfulness shows us holding, clenching, grasping, craving, clinging. Sometime, just by seeing the clinging, the grasping, the holding, we can let go. You know, we can just relax. We can just let go in the mind, let go in the body. Immediate relief. We let go of holding, relief. That's the end of suffering in that moment. That's the end. You don't have to look any further. But, of course, we pick up something else to hang on to. But in that moment, there is it. Much of practice is just that, discovering that we are holding on and intentionally, willfully, letting go. But if we didn't see that we were holding on, if we didn't practice noticing the way things are, we'd never notice that we're holding on. And with that, we'd never get the opportunity to let go. We'd never see the end of that suffering. A second way that we see the end of suffering occurs when we momentarily or temporarily put aside the hindrances. Now, we're all pretty familiar with the hindrances. Aversion, desire, restlessness, doubt, sleepiness. There are times in our day when the mind is secluded from those hindrances. It might be brief. It might be just a few minutes in a sitting, or it might be a long period of time, where you just plop with things as they are. No resistance, no desire, no big deal, just the way it is. The mind at that time is not tormented. The mind is secluded from the hindrances. This is called mental seclusion. What a relief. Right there. What a relief. I mean, we've all had those other periods of time in practice where the hindrances are driving us nuts. You know, the judgment, the restlessness, the agitation, the stress, the fear, the... You know, and then we get this... Wow. It's not that the mind is quiet. It's not that the body has somehow disappeared. It's not that everybody else has disappeared. It's that there's no hindrances in the mind. The mind can do its work. Just be with things as they are. Be at ease with that. Great relief. We should really pay attention to those moments. They come. Every one of us has had many of those periods, many of those experiences today. Let's not let them go unacknowledged. Let's acknowledge. That is the end of suffering, right there. We don't have to wait till something else. Temporarily, momentarily. This is known as Tadanga Nirodha, the temporary cessation of suffering. A third way we experience the end of dukkha, when practice matures, when the factors of awakening, you know, the energy, the interest, the joy is there, the body's calm, tranquil, balanced, not reactive, when there's a real momentum to just being with things as they are without reacting. And again, early part of the retreat, it's not so apparent that the mind is developing equanimity. But still, there'll be periods of time, and as the retreat goes on, you'll see a little more, that the mind gets less reactive. Things happen, so what? Hey, you don't get caught. You don't get jerked around. You don't get kind of pulled here and there by how pleasant or unpleasant it is. You see things, That's the way it is. Okay. You're not living in denial. You're not living in reaction. You're accepting, acknowledging, and not reacting. The experience of equanimity is subtle. It borders on boredom, complacency, disconnection, disinterest. And so we might miss it. But mature and strong equanimity feels, the subjective feeling of it, the mind is light, agile, not reactive, able to be with whatever's happening, quite panoramic, actually. Events are ephemeral, insubstantial, not very solid. When we have that kind of relationship to the things that are happening in our body, in our mind, in our environment, great relief. Great relief. It's just things are the way they are. Again, the end of suffering. There's one further experience of the end of dukkha that practice leads us to. When this equanimity, non-reactivity is strong, insight arises. And there are three insights that are particularly liberating. And they're the insights into the three characteristics. The insight into impermanence. When we see moment to moment that whatever arises passes away, whatever comes into being leaves, whatever we become aware of ceases, when we're living at that level of perception, there is nothing to hold on to. There can be no craving for insubstantial things, for impermanent things. And the mind just doesn't even pick it up. There's no clinging, there's no craving, there's no identification, there's no grasping. The insight into impermanence disentangles the mind from everything. Because we see. And we know at a much deeper level than even what we see that you can't grab impermanent things. You can't hold on to impermanent things. Very liberating insight. Second insight is the insight into dukkha. We know what dukkha is. We see dukkha-dukkha. Nobody wants to grab on to dukkha-dukkha. We see viparinamita. We see the change. We don't want to grab on to things that change. And we see sankhara-dukkha, the oppressive nature. Who wants to cling to, identify with that? When we're living at the level of this perception, where we're seeing the dukkha characteristic of every experience, the mind will not hang on. It will not. It knows that it's futile, that there's no satisfaction in it. That's the very nature of the insight into dukkha. It is unsatisfying. Whatever this experience is, it is incapable of providing security, stability, and satisfaction. The mind sees there's nothing worth holding on to. Very liberating. The third insight is the insight into anatta characteristic. We'll talk more about it in the retreat. But essentially, it involves the perception that whatever is appearing in our minds, in our bodies, in our minds, is insubstantial. It is ephemeral. It is evanescent. There's really nothing solid about it. As solid as it may appear right now, or today, when the insight into anatta ripens, what we see is how mist-like, everything really is. And when people, events, experiences are really perceived to be as insubstantial as they are, there's nothing for the mind to grab onto. There can be no craving. There can be no clinging, no attachment, no identification. How do you identify with what's evaporating? How can you cling to the evaporating mist? You can't. This is not an intellectual... I mean, what I'm saying is only coming across as a theoretical intellectual. But at the experiential level, when you're experiencing the insubstantiality of events, the mind doesn't grab on. This is a profound, yet extremely subtle end of suffering. End of suffering. There's nowhere to go. That's it. I mean, you don't have to look any further. These three insights, the insight into impermanence, the insight into dukkha, the insight into anatta, the insubstantiality, these are the doorways to the unconditioned. When the mind is really saturated with this knowledge of impermanence, dukkha, and insubstantiality, the mind radically lets go. Radically lets go. And the unconditioned is obtained. Access to the unconditioned uproots the sources of suffering in the mind. It doesn't just put them on hold. It isn't just temporary. It's a permanent uprooting. Pulling out by the roots the sources of dukkha. So that they're no longer in the mind stream. Not now, not this lifetime, forever. This is relief from dukkha. This is a relief. Of the end of suffering, the Buddha proclaimed, it is deep. It's hard to understand. It's hard to see. It is so peaceful. It is so sublime. It's beyond reasoning. But it is realizable by those with wisdom. We use words like peace, contentment, sublime, to point to the experience. They're not the experience, but they point to the experience because it's the only words that even come close. The unconditioned has no size, no shape, no color, no flavor, no texture. Nothing about it can be described. Except it's the end of suffering. This third noble truth is to be realized by each one of us. Can't buy it, can't read it, and nobody can give it to you. We have to see for ourselves, realize it. It's not a matter of belief, it's a matter of practice. If we practice, we can realize it. And the fourth noble truth is the path that leads to this realization. The Eightfold Path. There are many ways to talk about it as eight qualities of heart and mind, or as three trainings. The three trainings are sila, samadhi, and panya, or living in harmony, which we do here by living according to the precepts, not harming each other or ourselves, abandoning the suffering that comes from disharmony in our human interactions, temporarily putting aside that level of suffering. The second training is samadhi, or the training in calming the mind down, tranquilizing the mind. bringing the mind out of its restless, anxious, fretful distraction. And when we're able to temporarily put aside the hindrances and gain that mental seclusion where the mind is secluded from the tormenting activity of the mind, then we realize a significant reduction of suffering. The mind at anxiety-less rest. But because conditions change, things change. You know, maybe it won't be like that tomorrow. Well, a third training or third practice, the training in the development of wisdom, seeing the way things are. And this we do in practicing insight or vipassana. Seeing that things arise and they pass away. Don't cling. Whatever arises, recognize it. Let it pass away. Don't hang on. We'll get it eventually. Nothing is worth hanging on to. And when we do, then we understand. Things arise and pass away. This brings us access to the happiness of peace. Because we understand impermanence, dukkha, and insubstantiality. This is the Buddha's path. Sila, Samadhi, Panya, the three trainings for eliminating dukkha from our life. This path is to be walked or to be developed by each one of us. This is what we do here. This is our whole life here. Trying to live the Eightfold Path. Live in harmony, calm the mind, see the way things are. We can all believe it. It's easy to believe. It makes so much sense. But that's not enough. It's living it. Realizing it on a moment-to-moment basis, deeply, inside here, you know, with our behavior, with our thoughts, with our emotions, with our body. This is how we develop the Eightfold Path in order to realize the Third Noble Truth, the end of suffering, the end of dukkha, by abandoning craving, the Second Noble Truth, which is the cause of dukkha, the First Noble Truth. Now, why did the Buddha teach the Four Noble Truths? Because, he said, it's beneficial. It belongs to the fundamentals of the holy life. It leads to disenchantment. It leads to dispassion. The Four Noble Truths lead to cessation, to peace, to knowledge. The Four Noble Truths lead to enlightenment, to nibbana. So let's sit for a moment. The third Zen patriarch put it this way. The great way is not difficult for those who are not attached to their preferences. If you wish to see the truth, then hold no opinions for or against anything. To set up what you like against what you dislike is the disease of the mind. And when the deep meaning of things is not understood, the mind's essential peace is disturbed to no avail. Thank you for listening to the Dharma.